everyone, I'm Justin Chisholm, welcoming you to the first episode of our April 2021 series of the Yacht Racing Podcast Extra. My guest this time is the French solo offshore racing skipper Charlie Dallin. He earlier this year took line honours in the Vendée Globe single-handed non-stop around the world race. Despite being first home, Charlie was not the overall winner, as the time allowance awarded to Yannick Vestaven for his part in the search and rescue operation to save fellow competitor Kevin Escoffier put Dallin down to second place. Nevertheless, to lead the Vendée Globe fleet home at his first attempt at sailing's toughest around the world race is a huge achievement, and I was delighted to be able to get the chance to find out the details of what it's like to race around the world on a state-of-the-art foiling a Mocha 60 all on your own. I talked to him about the highs and low points of the race. I quizzed him on what it's like to race through the Southern Ocean, arguably the world's most inhospitable environment, and talked about the extra pressure of being amongst the leaders in the most tightly fought Vendée Globe race ever. I also discovered just how tough that foil bearing repair was to carry out alone at the bottom of the world. There's all that and more for you to listen to, so let's get to the interview. Well, Charlie Dallin, welcome to the Yacht Racing Podcast Extra. It's great to finally have you on the podcast. And let me start by saying congratulations on a stunning performance in the Vendée Globe. We last spoke in Paris just before the start of the race, a few weeks before the start, and I wrote a story where I described you as a rookie with a winner's attitude. You nearly did it. You were first home. How's it been since you got back to land?
Well, thank you. How's it been? Well, it's been, yeah, it's a mix of different things to tackle. You know, you cross the line, then you less than 24 hours after the crossing the finish line, I was already in Paris. I spent 4 days there doing a press tour with a TV, radio, paper press, and then I came back to I went back to Ridney, back home, and the first week I was pretty much useless. I was at home sitting on the couch, you know, not being able to do much, you know, just trying to recover, sleeping a lot. But just maybe 10 days after the finish, I was already back in the yard. Apia was back in Cocano. So, you know, that was the time for debriefs, with the team, debrief everyone involved in the campaign, you know, being on a nutrition level, sleep side. All this aspect, and it's still going, still carries on. We haven't finished yet this aspect, and also you quickly have to decide what to do in a boat, you know. So you spend some time with the team, you know. So okay, what do we do? What do we change? What do we keep? What do we improve? How do we do to make APVR even faster and more reliable? So you know, you kind of straight, you know. Fairly rapidly, you're back in business, you know, because you have to, you know, the team is, you know, they've been waiting for the boat for 3 months, you know. So
yeah.
They're eager to get going.
Yeah. So you've been living in such close contact with the boat and they've been missing it. I guess that's the way to look at it. Those first few hours when you got back, I'm always amazed how, composed the skippers are when they finish a race like the Vendée Globe. In fact, there isn't another race like the Vendée Globe. Was it very difficult? Was it a massive culture shock to have so many people around you at that point?
Well, yeah, there is no transition in this transition. you spend 3 months at sea, and then the first I arrived at night. You know, a fairly big sea state. I had some fog most of the afternoon, and I got closer to Les Sables. I could see the lights, you know, on the reflecting the city lights reflecting on the clouds, and uh, I was And as I was getting closer, the first boats arrived, and then there was one, then two boats, and then, you know, thousands of boats around me. And then you got this the shore team jumps on the boat, my wife as well. And yeah, suddenly you're in this, media, not mayhem, but you know, you got all this big media pool, and you go from media to from one media to the other, and you know, you kind of, you know, you go where you're told, you know, you kind of lost, you know.
Yeah.
And also you've got this you know, this sort of euphoria, you know, to finally cross this finishing line. There's a really big sense of relief, you know, of finishing, because when you start a Vendée, you know that you'll have no break, you know, day and night, day after day, you know, you have absolutely no break for 3 months, you know, because even when the conditions are calm, there is always something to do, you know, either you've got something to repair, or you've got to plan for the next sail change, or the next weather option, you know, weather, and there is no break, you know, it never stops, you know, even when the conditions are calm, you know, there's always something to do or to plan. And so you know that the only time you actually will be able to completely, you know, relax is when you cross the finish line. So there is this feeling, you know, of finishing, you know, starting from Les Sables, coming back from Les Sables, you know, there's this bigger energy, you know, kind of euphoric, you know, and you've got this, maybe you're running on adrenaline, maybe, and it lasts for a few. For me, it lasted like for 3 days, I think, 3-4 days, you know. And when at the end of my press tour in Paris, I think all this energy kind of, you know, dropped, fell, and I had to sleep 1 hour on one of the on France 24, you know, TV channel, one of France's 24 channel, one of their coaches, you know, because I was just. Yeah, I could not do anymore. You know, had to sleep, and before, you know, the next day, you know, like you feel like, wow, well, actually the Vendée Globe is easy. You know, I'm in top shape. You know, I don't feel tired at all. But you're feeling this, but you know that it's not true.
Yeah,
it's an interesting feeling.
That's the adrenaline high kicking in, yeah. For sure. Yeah, and I guess you went from this world of coping on your own to suddenly. I'm really struck by the fact you're like, I just go where I'm told. I do this. I sit here. I answer this question. That's such a big change from being in control of your own destiny.
Yeah, that's it. Yeah, yeah. Because you have to decide for everything. You know, when do you tack? When you jibe? When do you change sail? When do you repair? When do you eat? When do you sleep? You know, you decide. You decide. You've got to control everything. And you're free, yeah. Essentially, you know, you're free to do what you do when you want to do it. When you step on shore, you know, it's you actually can, you know, because you kind of lost, you know, some, you know, you're not accustomed anymore, you know, with all these, you know, social interactions, you know, and if you could not, actually you could not even decide if you wanted to, you know, because you're just too tired, you know. You let everything go, and I was like that for the few days I was in Paris. You know, my Marie Astrid, my press, how do you call that?
Press manager.
She, you know, she said, okay, so I book a taxi, you know, in 20 minutes. Okay, can you, you know, come down from? Okay. So we're going to it at this time. Yeah, okay. so we finished with this media. We're going to that one now. Yeah, okay, sure. Yeah, let's go. You know, and just you're kind of happy to, you know, to do what you have to do. In well, you know, to let someone decide for you what you have to do.
And this is mainstream media as well that we're talking about, and we know that France is one of those countries that really takes the sporting public really take sailing to their hearts, and you will be a national hero now in France for your achievement. Is that what it feels like to you?
Well, I definitely don't feel like a hero for sure. You know, I feel lucky to be. You know, to have my job, to that my passion is my job, You know, there's not many people on this planet that can say that. I feel privileged to have sailed the Vendée, but I don't feel like a hero, you know. But I do feel a big difference between before and after Vendée. I get often recognized in the street.
Right.
I was in Paris at the beginning of the week, and your people would come to me and say, "Oh, well done for the Vendée," you know, and this sort of thing. And it's kind of, it's weird, you know, because there's a big change at this, you know, on this level, you know, from, you know, and then from, you know, before and after. And I don't think I completely felt what it could have been because of, obviously of COVID. There's much less event following the Vendée, you know, and much less social interaction. You know, that's the point of lockdown and such. But I do feel a big difference from before.
And I'm sure Marie Astrid has explained to you that you know the upside of the COVID pandemic was that while the race was on, there was massive attention to it, and all around the world, and not outside of France as well, there was huge interest in the race, and it was a pretty interesting race to follow. It must have been a bit different to maybe how you expected it to be. It was your first race.
Yes.
Did you imagine it was going to be such a close battle between so many boats?
No, because the standard way the Vendée Globe pans out is you've got, you know, like maybe 2 to 5 boats escaping from the rest of the pack after Cape of Good Hope, and then and then distances, you know, stretches more and more, and it doesn't been the case this time around. That kind of happened with Thomas Rion. You know, we're we managed to create a gap from the rest of the fleet, but the weather conditions we encounter made that the rest of the fleet could manage to catch up on us, and this trend kept going. You know, every time someone or a group of boats would create a gap from the rest, and then the fleet would regroup due to the weather configuration. So I was not expecting this.
Yeah,
for sure.
Yeah, and that, I mean, I'm guessing that made it a much tougher race because the pressure was on from a competitive point of view all the time.
Yeah. It was till the finish. You know, when I arrived back in even in the Gulf of, in the Bay of Biscay, you know, I decided to go close to Cape Finisterre of Spain, and decided to, you know, to make a lot of jibes to take advantage of the wind acceleration along the Cape, and that was pretty intense to do this after 80 days of sailing, you know, 80 days at sea, you know, jibing, you know, every hour or so for. That was pretty tense, and even my last jibe, you know, I tried to make it as awfully sad, but I tried to save every second I could, you know, before crossing the finish.
Yeah, I want to talk to you about the finish a bit later on. Let's go back to the start day. The build up to the race was different because of COVID. The race village numbers of people just weren't there, mm-hmm. but it's still a special atmosphere, isn't it? Before the start of the Vendée Globe, when you're in the race village, just between your team and the other teams and the other skippers. Can you talk about that a bit?
Well, you feel tension, you know, for sure. You know, everyone knows that the start is, you know, the clock is ticking. The start day is getting closer and closer, and you know, everyone wants to, in a team, wants to do a good job, make sure all their part is okay, you know, everything is ready to go, I had to do a quarantine before the start, so I was not seeing anyone anymore, you know. The night before was, I think, where I was the most tense, because yeah you you know it's tomorrow, you know.
Yeah.
You know it's school day tomorrow, the day after. You know you've got to go for it. Yeah, and the last night is a very tense. I think the most tense moment for me. That was the night before.
Did you sleep that night before?
Yeah. I managed to sleep, but it's the next morning and it's your last night in a normal bed, in not moving environment. And in the morning you take your last real shower and you get out of bed, it's the last time you get out of a real bed for 3 months. And once you leave the car and get out of the car and do the and see the press and get on the boat, it starts to get a bit different. But to me the most tense moment was the night before. I was just alone with Bahrain. We said bye to our son, who stayed in Brittany 3 days before. So it was just her and me, and I tried to make most of this last hours before setting off.
How has she coped with you being away on this race? As you know, you've been back a while now. You must have talked about it because it's often forgotten.
That was not easy. that was not easy for her. Especially when I think I was fairly okay when I was in the Atlantic, but I was probably the hardest part for her was when I was in the South, in the Indian Ocean, Pacific, especially when I was, trying to tackle, storms, big low pressures. I think it was the most stressful moments for her, for sure. Yeah.
Did you speak to her a lot? Yeah. Every day, maybe, or
most of the day, most days, yeah, mm-hmm. most days, and sometimes we even managed to do a video. But the internet connection through satellite is pretty slow, so it's very pixelized.
Yeah,
but you kind of see something, we were speaking very, fairly often. One day, that was a very good memories for me. Before the race, I took pictures of one of my son's book. He's 2.5 years old. He's very young, but I had a book, one of his book in pictures. So at night time, I called home and I read the so he could hear me, and I was reading his book as my Perrine was turning the pages. That was a good moment.
That's great. That's so good. That's so good. Yeah, because I think it's forgotten, that the families have to kind of get on with normal life as well as worrying about their partner who's doing battle with the oceans. She must have been very happy to have you home.
For sure. Yeah.
was it hard to reacclimatize to kind of normal family life? Did she ease you in gently, or did she say, "All right, it's your turn now"?
Well, at the beginning, it's like, okay, so there's this and this to do in the house. No, now you're back, but after a few days, she realized how tired I was. I gained a few weeks on things I had to do, things I had to catch up in the house. I was happy to be back for sure. And I was happy to come back to a routine.
Yeah, for sure. Now let's go back to the start of the race. Was it easier once you got on the boat and the shore crew jumped off? Was there a little sense of relief that, all right, let's just get into this now? And
yeah, well, this moment is very special indeed, because you set off with your team. Sail through the channel, hoist the mainsail. Start with your routing checks, pilots, electronics, everything, hydraulics, and then you get close to the start time, and we had this sheet with what do we do at what time, and so you go through your checklist as the time, as the clock ticks, and after a while it's time for the first guys to jump off, and then there is less and less people on the boat, less and less voices. And you know that once they jump off, they're not coming back on board, you know. And when the last guy jumps, you know, you find yourself alone, and there is no more voices on board, you know. There is no one, not anymore person to talk to, or you can't ask anyone to do something, you know, to do a check for you. So yeah, you're on your own, and there is no, you know, there is silence, you know, and you know that there is no return, you know. Once they're all off, you know, you're on your own, and the last time you'd be help is when you actually be back in the same area, but three months later. So yeah, it's you know, I don't really like starts, you know, because there is a very big density of boats around, other competitors, spectator boats. You know, you have to try to manage your timing, your right timing to the start line, avoiding collision. It's a tense moment. You know, I was actually more relieved, you know, once, you know, after a few hours when the split started to spread out a bit, and you kind of try, you're able to go into a normal race rhythm. But the hours surrounding the starts, I don't really like this moment, you know, because there's always this shadow of you know, for collision with someone or missing your star. Or, you know, so yeah, once it's all going, I felt relieved the first night, you know, going into the first night, you know, I knew that, you know, I managed my star, you know, everything was on track for the race.
Did you give yourself a little moment to just appreciate the fact that here you were on the start line of the Vendée Globe? Because as we know, just getting to that point is a huge achievement for anybody.
Yeah, for sure. You know, you tell yourself, okay, you know, once I told that to myself once the start once the start was over, you know, and I could actually contemplate a bit, you know, and say, right, okay, you know, you've been dreaming for this for so many years, you know, you're doing it, you know, you're part of it now. So it's a good feeling. And but also you've got this feeling of, okay, you know, I know a lot of things will happen to me. I know I will have to tackle lots of low pressures and storms and things to repair on the boat, but you don't know what, you know.
Yeah.
you know things will happen to you, but you don't know when, and you don't know what, and you know you've got a lot on your hands.
Yeah.
But you don't really know, you know, what will, you know, what weather you will encounter and what the race will be. So yeah, it's a interesting feeling.
I've heard it described as there's something every day. There'll be something to deal with every day, at least one thing every day that will.
Yeah. Some Michel Lejoyeau says, yeah, Vendée is one problem a day. It's. At the beginning, for me, it was not really the case, you know. Going down the Atlantic, I didn't have that much problem. I lost my radar 2 days in the race. I had small problems, but not major. I didn't have much problem at all going down the Atlantic. I did a bit of carbon repairs in the South Atlantic, but it didn't take me too long. I didn't have sail problems or major, you know, electronics problems. And so, you know, I saw, all right, okay, things are going well, great, you know, but things getting, you know, in the South emotions, that's when I started to have more problems, you know.
The first big stage of the race down the Atlantic, it seemed for a while, just watching the tracker, and of course that's all we can see. We see the stuff that comes back from the boats, but it's often hard to get a full picture. But it seemed from us watching that you were kind of biding your time a little bit. You were just kind of holding, you know, you weren't pushing at the front. You weren't mid-fleet. You were just somewhere just nicely positioned. Was there a strategy there to?
At what point? Sorry,
just I think before. Before the South Atlantic, you know, and kind of crossing the equator and then down.
Well, I made the choice 3 days in the race. We encountered the tropical storm, Theta.
Yeah.
What's the name? And I took the decision to avoid the center of it. And because I felt I was too early in the race to take such risks. And I lost a lot of ground doing this, but that was my choice. And I managed to catch most of this of the miles of the lost miles, you know, sailing, getting in the southern Atlantic, and also as I was getting closer and closer to Alex Thompson, he started to have structural problems. So he had to slow down, and then I managed to catch up on Thomas Rion and overtake him. It's not like I took it easy, but also I was learning, you know, that was my first Vendée. That was only my second time single-handed on an IMOCA racing. So, you know, I was still very much still in the learning process, you know, how to sail these boats solo while racing. You know, it was only the second race for me ever, you know. So every day I was learning something, and so I was getting more and more sharp on my sail choices and strategy and so on, and sleeping and everything. So I managed to catch on Thomas, and I managed to have a pretty, he had a few problems to sort as well with his falls and Halyard and so on. And I managed to have up to a 300 nautical mile lead at this time, which was good. You know, everything was going to plan as I was entering the Indian Ocean, you know, but things got a bit more complicated later on.
Yeah, they did. I wanted to ask you, when we spoke in Paris, you talked about how much you'd been involved with designing your boat, and I remember smiling when you said, when I saw the size of the foils, you know, I knew I had to make this boat as comfortable inside for me, you know, make sure I could survive it. So after a week or so at sea, what was your view of the boat? Were you still in love with this boat at that point?
Yeah. Well, for sure. Yeah. They're pretty, you know, violent shocks, you know, in these boats, you know, they're pretty brutal, you know. I made my best 30-minute run of Brazil. I think as the best average speed of the entire fleet on the Vendée, I managed to sail 26.6 knots average on 30 minutes. And I think I was sleeping at that time. they're pretty fast boats for sure. And the Atlantic is the sea state in the Atlantic was except when we were sailing around the Ceuta, the sea state was in the Atlantic is most of the time okay, and you can really push the boats and go really fast, you know. And that was not so much the case in the south. You know, we were really we had a speed, you know, virtual speed cap, you know, with the sea state we were encountering. You know, we just not could push, you know, and so that made having a more powerful boat, you know, more powerful engine, shall I say, with big falls and so on, not an advantage at all, you know, because we just could not go quick. I did a couple of violent nosedives, you know. I managed to get myself a black eye when I was getting close to Cape Horn, you know. I fell a few times in the boat. You had to be cautious, you know, when moving in the boat and you know, you have to be holding to something all the time, because you could just, you know, fall and hurt yourself very easily.
Did your kind of confidence and comfort level of moving about in the boat, did it increase quite dramatically over the period of the race? I guess you were more able to deal with it by the time you got to Cape Horn, maybe.
Yeah, probably, but you sort of get more tired.
Yeah.
So you know, in the end, I don't feel like I became a ninja on the boat, you know. Even though my body was getting more accustomed to the motion of the boat, you know, my body was getting tired at the same time. So I didn't feel like I was, you know, more comfortable moving on the boat, you know, like, you know, it applies also to the time it takes you to do a maneuver, you know, like the more days, weeks, months passes on, the slower you are maneuvering, you know, even though you know the boat better, you know everything more, you know, everything is really in your blood and in your, you know, every you don't have to even think when you're doing a maneuver, but it doesn't, it's not enough, you know, because you're getting more and more tired and more weak, you know, weaker and weaker. Your maneuver time just get, you know, just, you know, big, you know, it's more slower and go slower and slower, you know, and yeah, it takes more, it feels like it takes more effort to do your maneuver and more time every time. And yeah, it's, you feel like you're getting more and more, you know, weaker and weaker and more tired for sure as the race goes on.
And that must affect your strategy as well, because you can't, you know, you're not just going to say, well, let's just throw a jibe in and see what happens. You're going to think every maneuver.
Yeah, for sure. Yeah, you try to, you know, to save yourself as much as possible, and you know the rate of maneuver, you know, you try to decrease it a bit, and you try to find routes that would be easy on sail changes, and you try to find like a compromise, but you probably have to compromise more than normal, for sure, you know. And yeah, you have to take this into account for sure when you're choosing a route.
Now, I want to ask you about some of the other teams, some of the other skippers experience problems, some notable names, some potential race winners. Jeremy Bayou had to turn back for repairs. Alex had his repairs. We saw Nicolas Troussel dismasted. And of course, Kevin's famous thing, which we'll talk about in a little bit more detail in a sec. When you get the news of these crises for the other skippers, how do you feel? Because you are competitors, but you're also bonded to these people as well, aren't you? These are your friends.
Yeah, for sure. Well, it's never a good news when you hear someone is retiring, for sure, because you know you know more than anyone, you know, how much effort it takes to get ready to prepare such a race. You know, it's years of work and preparation for the skipper, but also for a big team, and it's also you know, commitment from a sponsor, and you know, it's never a good thing for sure when someone retires, and when I heard the news that Jeremy was turning back, you know, I just really felt for him, you know, because that definitely would have been my worst nightmare at the time to turn back, you know, only 2 days in, 2 or 3 days in the race, you know, that would have been, I can relate and really understand how much or hard it would have been, a heartbroken it would have been for Jeremy to turn back, you know, and this applies for all the other skippers that to abandon, you know, it's definitely something you don't wish to occur to anyone.
Does it also kind of focus you in on just the risk for yourself of that happening to you as well? Because there is an element of chance to it, you know, the thing that Alex hit with his rudder, you know, any of you could have hit that, right?
Yeah, for sure. And you obviously think about it, and every time say someone has a problem, not necessarily like retiring, you know, a problem that requires a retirement, but some boats have hook problems, so you ask your team, you know, can you call the manufacturer, you know, try to find out what went wrong, was it a human error, was it a problem in the mechanism, you know, and you try to learn, you know, from other people's problems, so it doesn't happen to you, you know.
Yeah.
I was, when you sail south of Africa, you know, there's this current coming down from the eastern coast of Africa, and there is a lot of potential debris in the swirls, you know, in the whirlpool there. In, you know, there's a lot of currents. There's also a lot of sea life there. And that's when I was sailing through this zone, you know, I was really, you just hope not to hit something, you know. I had a pinger in my keel bulb to you know, the idea is try to scare off sea mammals and whales and such, and you hope it's working, you know, and you hope you're not going to hit like a tree or something, a tree trunk at this point. Once you pass this era, you know, there's less chances to hit something. So you have this sense of relief, but you know, every time, every Vendée, you know, once or two or couple of more boats have had collision problems, in this area, you know, so once you've passed it, you know, you feel the relief.
Right. And by this stage, you were leading the race. You said a little while back there that, you know, everything was going as planned. So you were in this race to win it, right? You were expecting to be amongst the leaders at this point.
Yeah, well, winning it, I didn't know, you know, but I had, you know, we prepared to be able to be in a position of winning. You know, you don't, you know, the Vendée is such a long race. You never know what will happen to you, you know, but we did everything to be in that position. And after the race, you know, it happens what it happens, you know, and, a lot of skippers that are, having winning ambitions, you know, had to stop, and that could have been, you know, maybe our case as well, you know, so you never know what will happen, but everything was going to plan, was going well. Had this big lead on the rest of the fleet getting into the Indian Ocean, and I encountered a couple of storms. The first storm I encountered, that was the following day, Kevin Escoffier broke his boat. That added a bit of stress to me. You know, I was discovering the Indian Ocean, and the day before, I didn't sleep much the night before, because, you know, I was like everyone, I was anxiously waiting for news on Kevin's rescue. So at this time I decided not to slow down or not to change my course to sail around, or I could not sail around, but I could have slowed down a lot to avoid this storm. I looked a lot at the wave size and wind speed and everything, and I decided to go for it. But when you hear that someone is in his life raft, you know, you can't help telling yourself, okay, did you make the right decision? You know, is what you're going to encounter, is that going to be okay? You know, so you can't avoid thinking that, but I was the only one going to encounter this first storm. And then the second one, we were two in it. The biggest one I had, like, what was the name of the islands? I don't remember, but in the middle of the Indian Ocean, this big storm, the biggest I encountered, with huge winds. 2 hours before the wind was supposed to kick in, I lost my second aerial sensor, so I will never know how much wind I got in this storm. But I think that was big.
When you say you lose it, they just blow off the top of the mast.
Yeah, it broke. One of the pieces broken. And I lost the first one in the Atlantic. So yeah, I was blind on wind instrument for at the time of the race.
Wow. How much does that impact you? I mean, you say blind. It must feel like you are sailing a little bit blind.
Yeah. Because, you know, you on these boats, especially for me, you know, I've got a enclosed cockpit, and even if you don't have an enclosed cockpit, there's so much waves going on, you just simply cannot put, you know, stick your head out and feel the wind on your face, you know, so I managed to put a little pole at the back of the boat, a 2 meter long pole with a spare aisle wind instrument I had, but you know, it was not working well. the wind direction and speed were not accurate. So, you know, that was kind of, you know, helping me on the pilot, but that was not great. And so I sailed all the half of the Indian Ocean and all the Indian entire Pacific with bad wind instruments. So my pilot was not steering that well.
Wow.
Yeah, I didn't have much info on, very inaccurate info on wind speed and wind direction. So that was not great for my pilot, for the performance of my autopilot and sail choices and such. But you know, you have to adapt, you know, you have to adapt and find new ways. You cannot, in the Vendée, you cannot survive if you're not able to adapt, you cannot survive the race for sure. You know, that's the key word, you know, adaptation. You know, you have to adapt to how your boat is evolving through the race. You know, you spend your time losing, components and potential, and some things sometimes you can repair, sometimes you cannot, and you have to, yeah, constantly you have to adapt. You know, once I could not use my port foil, once I lost the bottom bearing, I had to, you know, I had to adapt to a new sailing style when I was on starboard. You know, that was not the same stacking, that was not the same sail choices according to wind speed and wind angle. But you've to survive, you have to adapt. That's the only way.
Let's talk about that repair, because it was, you know, for fans of Charlie Dallin at that point in the race, it was the news that nobody wanted to hear, was that, you know, you would, because up until then you'd kept it fairly quiet what had gone wrong on your boat. I mean, I don't remember hearing about the wind instruments.
No, we didn't talk about it.
Yeah, which is, you know, all part of the game. And then, you know, we realized that you've got this problem. So talk us through it. How did you discover it, and what was your thought process?
Well, I was nearly south of Australia then. Everything was okay. You know, I still, even though the back of the fleet managed to caught up a bit on me, you know, I still had a 100+ mile lead. So, you know, everything was going well, you know. And then one night I was starting to see, I started to see water coming out of my Harrier tunnel, and that was weird because that never happens normally. So I told this to my team on WhatsApp, and you know, not much. And then, you know, I felt something was not right, and so I started inspection, you know, and I realized that my the second thing happened is that I had a flooding alarm, started to ring in the boat, and I was in the foil area. So okay, so I went to check and I saw if, you know, water there, and I tried to work out where the water was coming from, and then I realized that my port foil case was full of water. And that's not normal. And then I start to look in through the little window we've got in the foil case, and I saw that the foil was moving a lot, you know, was moving in all directions, and that was not normal, you know. and then I slowed down. I took a little camera I retracted the foil. And then I realized that the bearing was gone, you know, and I was, yeah, that was a heartbreaker, you know, that was really hard at that time. You know, I called my, Antoine Carras, technical manager, and yeah, I told him that we lost these bits, and yeah, that was a tough moment, for, few hours I thought the race was over.
Right.
I really believed we were going to head, you know, either to somewhere to you know, end up in a port somewhere in Australia or New Zealand, and yeah, that was a tough moment because, you know, everything was well, you know, everything was going good, and then when you realize that you know if you're going to lose your lead and probably retire, and yeah, it's not easy. So, and then,
so how many hours did you have to wait before, I'm guessing the shore team came back and said, look, we've got a potential solution here?
Well, I think they all met in the HQ in the Apiva HQ in Concarneau, and they started to work on the plan, you know, Apollo 13 style.
Yeah.
Was he on board? What can we make him do? And so they worked all night on this, and then for me, you know, the sun. And once the sunrise, I received just before the end of the night, I received a very detailed PDF plan of action.
Wow!
And when I read it for the first time, I told the guys, "Come on, you know, I cannot do that. You know, you see how many steps and lines and things to do. Is there, you know, that really felt impossible to achieve, you know, alone in the Southern Ocean, you know." But I started going, you know, I retrieved all the carbon planks, I was supposed to use, you know, starting to draw the cutouts of it, you know, and I went for it, you know. I was fairly lucky on the weather because, the weather was calm that day, you know, that was a sunny day, not much wind. So I could get on with the job, you know, and I was lucky on that side. So when everything was ready, when the bearing was this replacement bearing was ready and the glue was cured, you know, I jived and I made the body heel as much as I could, and hung myself on a halyard and started to go back and forth from the, you know, cockpit to the daggerboard case to adjust the bearing, the bearing for it to fit the most perfectly as possible to the case and the fall. And that took me a long and long time. You know, I probably, I don't know how many, I did countless, I went a countless time back and forth between the cockpit and the side of the boat, you know, to try to adjust it. And the hours were, you know, time was passing and going by, and I started to feel the tiredness, you know, of all these hours and hours of work, and could see the sun slowly, you know, going down on the horizon. I thought to myself, well, you have to have this bearing in before it's nighttime, because otherwise, you know, it's going to be over. So you push, you know, you keep pushing, and just before it got dark, you know, I managed to get the bearing in, you know, I jigged back, deployed the sail, and it was completely dark when I was going again, you know, it was just dark, you know, so that was really a matter of, you know, of minutes before I gave everything up, you know, once I was going again, I went to sleep.
Yeah.
I went to sleep for a long time.
And how quickly did you understand that the repair had worked? Was it obvious straight away, or?
No, because we didn't know, you know, we didn't know if it was safe to carry on like this, you know, sail through the biggest ocean in the world with this at sea repair, we didn't have much time to, we had only a few days to validate the repair, you know, because when I started again, we still didn't know if we could carry on the race, you know. Yeah. Because we didn't know it was going to be enough, you know. So I pushed the boat on starboard to try to see, you know, what was happening, if everything was staying in place, and once we were south of New Zealand, we felt like it was okay, and so we decided to carry on with the race. But that was just not a, you know, one day repair. You know, I had to slow down and heel the boat over a few times afterwards. This we didn't talk about all the time. But I had to nurse this repair, yeah, all the way to the finish. You know,
yeah.
Even in the Bay of Biscay, one of the main ropes holding the foil broke, so I had to slow down another time, once again to you know, to sort it out, you know. So yeah, that's something I had to deal with all the way to the finish nearly.
Yeah, we saw as you crossed the finish line, we saw that rope probably for the first time, because I think you kept that one quiet on the photos as well. That was just taking some of the load off the bearing, I guess. Was it just giving some support to the foil?
Yeah, trying to hold the foil as much as possible and making sure it was not moving, not damaging the case furthermore. So that was not easy to hold this big foil, you know, in place, you know. Because you know, as soon as you get a bit of speed and water goes over it, well, obviously it wants to move back, to move up, to move down, and it was pretty hard to control, you know.
Yeah. So you're back in the race. You're back. You know, how quickly could you reset your brain to, all right, we're not just surviving now. We are going to finish. We're going to try and finish this race, and we're still competitive.
Once I really felt a big relief once I sailed around Cape Horn, you know. Once I sailed around Cape Horn, you know, I knew I was back in the Atlantic, you know. I knew there was, you know, land not far away, you know, and I felt like I could start, you know, pushing a bit more on the boat, you know, with also like a calmer sea state. So you know, less constraints on the falls, I felt from that point on that, you know, I could, once I sailed around Cape Horn, I felt like I would be able to go all the way to the finish, you know, and I was able to push a bit more, but going up the Atlantic, most of the time you're on starboard side. So unlikely for me, you know, I lost the port bearing. That was tough sailing with a very much diminished boat speed potential at this time.
What percentage of 100% were you sailing with that damage?
Well, I think I was losing 10 to 15% speed potential. Maybe sometimes more, you know. So yeah,
that's frustrating.
It was pretty frustrating, you know. I think I could have. I probably lost like maybe four. I estimated the lost the maybe to 400 nautical miles, maybe going up the Atlantic, something like this. You know, because if you take into account the doldrums and the semi permanent cold front of Rio, you know, there's. Yeah, I think that was probably, in the end, that would have been something like 400 miles.
So, that's tricky. Before we get too far up the Atlantic, I want to ask you about the Southern Ocean, your first experience of it properly, and you had some experiences down there. Can you describe the place for us? Because not many people get to go down there, so I'm always interested to find out.
Well, it's like everything is supersized, you know. You've got big winds, you've got you know, it's cold. You've got big waves, big storms. Everything is big. You know, the oceans are big. It's a very hostile environment. You kind of feel you're not really welcome there. You know, you kind of feel it's not your normal place to be. You know, very special atmosphere down there, and even the winds, you know, you look at the winds prediction on the grip files, and there is always more. It's often gray, and you know, the South Pole is not too far. It's a bit like a tunnel, you know. once you're in there, you know, the only way out is ahead. You know, you cannot turn back because the winds are blowing mostly from the west. It's And also you feel a distance because of the time difference. You know, you're when you're by New Zealand, south of New Zealand, you know, you're on the opposite time zone, and you're leaving. It's daytime when everyone is asleep in Europe, and you do feel like you're far away from home at the time, and also you've got this which is really weird. It's like every day you've got like a 30-minute or 30-minute to half an hour time change. The sunset and rise. There's a big offset that is done as you go every day. You know, it's changing a lot, so it's quite hard to accustom to this this changing in time zone. And also you do feel a lot also the cold, you know, when you start getting close to the ice gate, you know, you feel it's getting very fast, very rapidly, much colder. And when you have to go back up, then the temperature rises fairly rapidly as well. And also that applies to the daylight as well. As soon as you go a bit further north, you start to having real nights, and when you really south, when I was really deep south, so just before Cape Horn, you know, at Victoria, I had no nights, you know, that was just dawn, you know, for a few hours, you know, and you don't see absolutely no one, you know, when you launch marine traffic on your computer, you just see that. So there's absolutely no ship.
It's just you
at all. You know, this south and and also you do have the sense of scale back when you go back to the Atlantic. You know, I really felt like the Atlantic was small when I came back. You know, because you measure distances between islands or from you to the coast, and it's never big. You know, it's never big numbers. You know, I really felt like the Atlantic had shrunk, or I really felt the Atlantic was really small compared to what I saw when I was sailing in Pacific, particularly.
It sounds like an inhospitable place, but is there any beauty down there?
Oh yeah, for sure. You know, you've got this, obviously the albatrosses. Their flight is just amazing, and we had some amazing sunset and sunrises and in the sea state when you're in a storm, you know, it's kind of, you know, magical, you know, and you know that a very, very small percentage of the population has been there or will have been there very small percentage of the population has been in this area, and you kind of, you know, you feel privileged, you know, to see that from your own eyes, you know.
So, like everybody that I've spoken to about the Southern Ocean, they always tell me they're glad to get out of there. And as you say, you rounded Cape Horn and you headed back into the narrow confines of the Atlantic Ocean. But then we had an amazing race between so many boats as the fleet compressed. How did you manage to? I mean, first of all, were you just like, seriously? Come on, you know, let's just have a nice straight run back to France now. But suddenly, you're in a Figaro race, aren't you?
Yeah, yeah. Well, I was kind of happy, you know, because the first part of the first half of the South Atlantic was pretty hard on me because I had to tackle this migrating high pressure, moving from the coast towards the east, and everything I could do, any route I was routing, I would try, I would sail into it. You know, when I was getting, if I went close to the shore, I would hit it early, but I would still hit it. I was saying, if I decided to go further east, now I would eat it later, but I would still eat it. So there was no options for me, you know, and I had to sail through this high pressure. At this time, Yannick Bestaven's lead stretches to 450 nautical miles because there's nothing I could do. So that was pretty tough, you know, this because I said, all right, you know, I could see that I was going to have a really big lead. And also I knew he had this 10-hour time allowance, you know, and that was a tough part. But I finally went through this, you know, I took advantage of this calm wind to go up the rig, to set up a replacement, to repair my wind instrument. So I was pretty chuffed, you know, pretty happy to finally be able to use my autopilot to its full potential and have a reliable wind speed and direction. So, you know, I felt pretty pumped, you know, from this point. And then I saw that it was going to be hard to cross this permanent cold front of Rio de Janeiro, and that was going to be hard, especially hard for Yannick. And I felt that maybe something was still possible, you know. So I managed to caught up on him to overtake him as well, to go from 450 miles. How do you say that?
Behind.
You know, behind to more than 100 miles in front, you know. But obviously, you can't have everything, you know.
Yeah.
So obviously, I was not the only one to benefit from this weather situation, and a lot of guys that caught up on me as well. But this I didn't mind, you know. What matters to me was that to catch up on Yannick, you know, and. You know, I felt confident I could deal with everyone, you know, that won't just, but what I had to do is to catch up on him, you know, and I felt confidence on my tactics and ability to choose the right route to manage this lead well. And that's what happened, you know, even though I managed to get this big lead on everyone. Again, after this Rio passage, but then from Recife to Doldrums, that was pretty tough on me because, you know, I got caught up by Bureau Valley because, you know, he still had Bureau Valley and Boris Herrmann.
Yeah.
They both had their portfolio working. I lost a lot of ground on them at this point, and that was tough because I really felt like I will not be able to do much, you know, and just by speed they will sail away from me, but I work hard on my Doldrums passage and it went pretty well for me, and then I decided to go for route further east than Bureau Valley, and that worked pretty well for me, and so I managed to hold on that lead even though my boat was much slower at the time, I really fought hard. I was sailing like at between 25 and 30 degrees of hill angle to try to put my foal a bit in the water to get a bit of a riding moment of it, because I could not, you know, put it in the water, and that was pretty intense race. But you know, I'm accustomed to this. You know, I've done so many figure races, and I didn't feel that was the boats were that close compared to my standards. You know, when you're sailing figures, you have like 15 boats around you that you can see with your own eyes, you know, and then the boats were close, but I could, you know, where they're still far away enough to, so I could not see them. So yes, the race was close to the Vendée scale, but I was not close to a, you know, if you compare to a Figaro style race. And I also knew that the biggest heritage from this soul racing from all everyone around me. You know, Boris, he's never done the solitaire. Bureau Valley skipper, neither Yannick Destaven, hasn't. You know, the only one who's done a couple of solitaires was Thomas Ruyon. So I knew, you know, was the best Figaro sailors in the fleets. You know, so that gave me confidence on my ability to to sell hard and find the right tactics to keep this lead.
So you were re-energized at this point, I'm guessing.
Yeah. I felt confident down, on a one-to-one duel. I knew I had the skills and experience to come on top.
And you were fighting for the overall race win here, not just the line honors win.
Yeah. And this, if someone would have told me that when I was, attached to Harley on the side of my boat, trying to put a carbon bearing in the fall, a few weeks back, I would never trust this person for sure.
Yeah. No, I mean, it was just such a fantastic race to watch come to a culmination from the shore. We're watching these little dots on the tracker, and we're trying to glean from the bits of video that are coming off the boat. That last 24 hours at sea, is there anything you would do differently now looking back at that? Or maybe the last 48 hours?
The last 24 hours? You always find way to improve yourself for sure. I had only one furling drum left working on my bowsprit at the time, and I didn't find the time to repair the second one, and I wish I did, because then I would have saved time in maneuvers in the Bay of Biscay, and I probably would have been able to deploy my masthead downwind sail.
Right.
At some point then, but I couldn't. That was too time. That was too costly in maneuvering time to change. So, yeah, US find things to improve. But I don't know. I probably not have been enough to gain the 2 to 3 hours I was missing.
So it's probably an unfair question to ask you, but you won the race on the water in terms of line honors. The time that had been allocated to Yannick for the rescue, his involvement in the rescue of Kevin Escoffier, meant that he ended up winning the race. How do you feel about that, just in general terms?
Well, it's like I said after the finish. There is no question on. Well, to me, there is no debate on whether or not you should have this time allowance. It's like this. It's part of the rule. It's part of the game. But I don't feel like it's unfair. But it is still hard to But for me, it's still hard to live.
I can understand.
It's not an easy situation. But because I was that close to winning, it's normal. It's normal. This time around is not normal, but it's not easy to live for me for sure.
So is the Vendée Globe now a done deal for Charlie Dallin, or is there another race in it?
No, because I do feel my story, it's not finished. Maybe this chapter is over, but I don't think the book is, and I believe I've got some things to do with the Vendée in the future. I really hope I will be at the start of the 2024 Vendée with a competitive campaign. That's my biggest wish at the moment.
And what feedback did you get from Francois Gabart, because you've been working very closely with him on the build up for this whole campaign?
What feedback? We talk more on the operational side of things rather than the sailing side, because I'm the one who know, what I can do better. I know what I did, what I could have, where are the rooms for improvement. But I do believe I've improved a lot during the race. I learned a lot how to sail these boats and I do feel my sailing my IMOCA skills, my IMOCA sailing level is much, much higher now than it was before the start of the race. So I still believe I can improve more on certain points. If I manage to be on the start line on the next Vendée with a competitive campaign, I do feel like I would be a stronger competitor for the race.
And I heard you say not long after the finish that the race had changed you as an individual, yeah, as a person, but you weren't sure how at this point. Are you any closer to understanding that?
Well, yeah, I think about this thing every day, and I have to find the answer, to be honest. It's not even 3 months since I finished the Vendée, and it's still fresh. You know, I'm still in the recovering stage. I'm still very tired. Tiredness is still really in depth in me, I'm still in a recurring stage. So I think I still need a bit more time for everything to settle and understand how the race has changed me. But it's 3 months at sea, you know, you've got the emotions you go through are huge, big, and it has changed me for sure. But I'm still have to find out how, really.
So Charlie, you're not done with the Vendée. You're looking for another competitive campaign, but in the nearer future, what can we expect to see from you?
Well, it's very exciting years to come with Apivia, because I've got the Transat Jacques Vabre at the end of the year, from Le Havre to Martinique, a double-ended race, setting sail on the 7th of November. I won the last edition. I'd like to win it for a second time in a row. And
do we know who you'll be partnering with?
I will be announcing that soon.
Okay.
And next year we've got the Route Drôme. It's a huge race in France as well. Not as big as the Vendée, but quite close. And I've never done this race before, and I'm looking forward to sail this legendary race.
So you'll be back on the water pretty soon in the boat that you've got so used to. That's great to hear. Well, listen, Charlie, the best of luck with those campaigns, and thank you so much for taking the time to talk to you. It's fascinating to get your take on such a unique race, and I've really enjoyed doing it. So hopefully we'll be able to speak after the Route de Rome.
Well, it was my pleasure, and speak to you soon. Thank you.
That's it for this episode of the Yacht Racing Podcast Extra. My thanks to Charlie Dallin for such a fascinating interview. And thanks also, of course, to all of you for subscribing and listening around the world. I really do appreciate it. I'll be back soon with our second exclusive member-only episode for April 2021, where my guest will be the veteran British ocean racer, Neil McDonald. Until then, I'll just say bye for now.